The chaos in downtown Oklahoma City did indeed resemble Beirut after what police believe to be a 1,200-pound car bomb ripped through the nine-story federal building shortly after 9 o'clock this morning. More than 500 people were already in their offices, and at least 50 children were in a daycare center on the second floor.
A massive car bomb exploded outside of a large federal building in downtown Oklahoma City, shattering that building, killing children, killing federal employees, military men, and civilians.
Bombing in Oklahoma City was an attack on innocent children and defenseless citizens. It was an act of cowardice, and it was evil. The United States will not tolerate it, and I will not allow the people of this country to be
intimidated. It seemed like war yesterday. The reinforcements showed up tonight. At the center of it all, of course, is the bombed-out shell of the federal office building, and in its shadow, the exhausted, who for a day and a half now have sifted through its debris and counted its dead and seen up close why they call it terror.
At 9:01 a.m. on April 19, 1995, the lives of people in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma State, and around the world would change. A domestic terrorist packed and parked a box truck with homemade explosives outside the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City, killing 168 people, including 19 children, and leaving hundreds more injured. Among those killed, the Secret Service lost six employees that day, four special agents, and two administrative, professional, and technical personnel. This past February, I was fortunate enough to be given a special opportunity to meet and interview four family members of fallen U.S. Secret Service employees who perished on that day 25 years ago. I spent the week listening to their stories and discovering who these amazing individuals were. I want to say thank you to the families for opening up their homes to me and the crew and talk about their loved ones. Thank you. Now, please join me for a very special episode of Standing Post. So the first thing we want to do is, if you can, if you both can state your names.
Alice Ann Dennison.
Mickey Paul Maroney.
And I would like to start out with, just talk a little bit about the connection that you had with the Oklahoma City bombing incident and who you are, you know, who you lost in the incident.
My dad was Mickey Bryant Maroney. He was United States Secret Service on the ninth floor. I'm his daughter, and this is my brother.
We lost our dad in the bombing, along with his coworkers and lots of friends.
And how were you both, can you kind of walk through the morning of that day?
I was woken up by the bombing, shook my house, shook the windows, didn't know what it was, just kind of woke up, wasn't sure what was going on, and got a phone call from my ex-wife, stating she thought that a building blew up downtown, and that's all I knew. So I knew Dad was downtown, the building, and so I got dressed, went downtown, and picked up my ex-wife on the way, and I think we were there within an hour, and came from the south side of the building, so I couldn't see what actually happened, but I saw crazy traffic and lots of people and just smoke. And so I kept thinking that it was the building across the street, and because I couldn't see the front of Dad's building. And once I realized kind of what was going on, that I didn't know where he was or what was going on. So I tried to get in the back side of the building to go up, and highway patrol stopped, and I told him who I was and what I was doing, and he said, "You need to sit down here." So I sat on the curb next to the church and waited for somebody from the Secret Service to let me know what was going on, and we can continue the rest after you talk about yours.
So I was at work, which is located about 12 miles north of Oklahoma City, And I just sat down to eat my breakfast, and I can recall exactly what I was wearing. I can tell you I had a blueberry muffin from Brahms that morning. Started to eat that, and it came over the radio that there was an explosion in downtown Oklahoma City. So we were listening to the radio, but somebody also had a little small transistor TV per se, black and white TV, and they said that it was the courthouse, which is located across the street from the federal building. So I said, well, you know, it's probably not that, and we'll just wait. I actually called the Oklahoma City field office, and it was a busy signal. And I said, we don't ever get a busy signal when we call the field office. So that gave me a little bit of concern. I called my husband. He was at work. He came and picked me up, and we headed south to downtown Oklahoma City. And obviously, we were stopped short. Had to park the car and go about 5 blocks, and that's when we saw the smoke on the building. Again, not really sure it was utter chaos, not sure where anybody was. I think what I expected was, okay, these people will be over here. You can find this floor over here. And obviously it was not like that at all. And then we went and we just waited for my dad to call or to check in. And obviously that didn't come. And I think we knew fairly early on that if he was okay, if he wasn't in the building, he would have called somebody. And so I think we knew fairly early on in that day that he did not survive.
How do you remember your father?
That's easy. He was our hero. Not only was he an amazing dad, but he was also an amazing friend. And through his loss, agents, friends would tell us stories that we knew he was cool. I mean, he was the best show and tell guy you're ever going to have for an elementary kid. But his huge heart, his giving, he did a lot of volunteer work. He was 6'4", so he was Frankenstein at the March of Dimes haunted house. He did all kinds of things where we knew he was a cool dad, but everybody else later on said, I worked with your dad, I stood post with your dad, I did detail with your dad. Your dad was amazing. Your dad went above and beyond. So for me as a daughter, I mean, he was my hero. He was my first true love. And he always will be. But to know that everybody else loved him and cared for him and respected him, that spoke volumes to me as his daughter, that everybody else felt the same way about him. Just, he wasn't the badge all the time. He was Mickey.
For me, he was just dad. And I knew he had an amazing job and traveled lots of places and had lots of stories and stuff that he couldn't say or tell, but to me, there wasn't a badge. It was just, my dad had a job. It was important. In school, when somebody, you have to write as an elementary kid, what do you want to be when you grow up? Most of it's Dallas Cowboy football player, Dallas Cowboy cheerleader, or a policeman, a fireman. I just said I wanted to be like my dad. Not a Secret Service agent, but that person, that good, wholehearted, warm, big hug man.
And do you find those characteristics kind of flowing through you? Do you look back to see those when you kind of navigate through life?
That's for her to answer.
We do. I do. He does. There's so many times. There's an example of Chaplain Poe, Jack Poe, who was retiring from the Oklahoma City PD, and I went to his retirement party, and I had not planned on speaking. I was just there as a guest, and a former agent, he's like, you need to get up and say something. I said, this is not my thing. He said, no, you need to get up. So I got up there, said a few things. I have a sense of humor. My dad has a great sense of humor. I got up there and just said some things, and after it was over, an ATF agent came over, and he said, had you not even said your name, I would have known you were Mickey Maroney's daughter. Just by your sense of humor and the way you carry yourself, you are definitely Mickey Maroney's daughter. And so I take that as a huge compliment. So I think we took some of his best characteristics, and I think they're in both of us as far as a sense of humor, as far as a kind and giving heart. I could say the same about our mother as well. So Dad doesn't get all the credit. Our mother does too. But I see a lot of my dad, our dad, in both of us.
do you both have a best memory, one that you'd like to share about when growing up? Well, I mean, it's up to you. I just wanted to see if you had one, if you'd like to share one.
I have. There's hundreds, but I just remember going bird hunting with my dad, quail hunting, and I was young. I started young hunting with him, bird hunting, quail hunting, dove hunting, but we would always go out with his high school buddies. And one time there were five Mickeys in the vehicle, and it was, I mean, I was always Mickey Paul. My dad was always Big Mickey, and then there's Mickey Pemberton, who's Pimmy, Mickey McShan, who's Mickey Mac. And so I remember quail hunting, and of course you're following dogs and all that stuff, and my dad wouldn't carry a gun, and it made no sense to me. Of course, I'm a little kid, and I'm wanting to shoot all the birds that you can just to brag. And he goes, I just like to watch the dogs work. Made no sense to me at the time. As I got older, as I got my own dogs and had the appreciation for being outside and just being with your friends, it made total sense. And so just watching the sunrise, watching the sunset, being outside, it's not about shooting birds. It's just about being with your friends or family and appreciate those things. So those are some big memories for me.
For me, several of them had to do with just the father-daughter bond that there is. I was always going to be his princess, which is so not me. But when I was at a sorority at Oklahoma State University, he would call me literally every day. And back then, you didn't have cell phones, so he's calling the landline. So I'm not there. My roommates are answering. He's asking my roommates, how's class? How's the boyfriend? How, you know, what's going on? And then 10 minutes later, finally, they're like, hey, your dad's on the phone. I'm like, oh, that's been my dad this whole time? So the girls obviously loved him. He was always bigger than life. As a high school girl, it's kind of hard to get a date when your dad's 6'4 and he's a Secret Service agent. I think that's a little intimidating, but it was also very fun because dad followed the rules, but he also made his own rule book. And this is all out there anyway, so he would follow boyfriends or girlfriends in the car. He'd turn on the lights, turn on the sirens, pull them over. I mean, you know, just having a good time. And everybody knew Mickey was in town. Mickey's in town.
He followed us.
He followed us around.
Undercover.
Hope we didn't do anything. But he always wanted to be assigned and asked to be assigned the counties that we were living in. Our parents were divorced, so when we lived in Stevens County, that was his county. When I was up at Oklahoma State, and when he came to Oklahoma State, then
He moved up to that territory.
And he was a dad that was hands-on. He wanted to be at Mickey's practices, not just his games, not just his football games, but his practices. He wanted to be at my events, few and far between. But he was an involved dad, but he was just bigger than life, and not because he made himself that way. It's because he showed people that that's who I am. We did go out and shoot the Uzi a few times too. We got taken backstage to concerts with the badge. It always helps to have a dad who's an agent, because I can't tell you, I haven't had that many speeding tickets, but I do have a lead foot because of my dad. He taught us how to drive. But I will remember on my wedding day, we couldn't afford a limo. That just wasn't in the budget. And my dad had called one of the ladies at the limo service, and he said, today's my daughter's biggest day, and I need to get her a limousine. And there's that limousine as we walk out of the church. And he said, my princess will always have what she wants. And he's my oldest Valentine. He brought me flowers on Valentine's Day, and on the card it said, from your oldest and most loving Valentine. He's a great man. Great man, great father.
You know, 25 years later here, where you are at today, who you are as people from the event, from your father's wisdom and personality, what 25 years later, who are you in relation to this?
We're changed. We'll always be changed from the second it happened. But I think we're changed. I'll speak for me. I think I'm changed for the better. Not that I was a horrible person then, but you have to find strength and you have to carry on. And our dad would not have wanted us to just have hate and to be doom and gloom and to just carry that with us for the rest of our lives. He would have wanted us to live and to raise our children and to have our families and to, you know, have a great work ethic and go to, I mean, we could have gone a totally different direction, and that's just not the direction we went, because that's not how our parents raised us. So for who we are now because of the event, we're still the same people. Part of us is gone, but I think he would be extremely proud of the people we are, the parents we are. I think he'd walk in that door and he'd say, "You did everything right."
I think she handled it much better than I did, and mine's been up and down, and I tried to be the man of the family and take care of everybody, which in hindsight was not the right thing to do because it didn't benefit me or my life and all that. So I've gone up and down and up and down, and especially after having kids, just responsibilities and wanting to be to them who my dad was to me, has changed my outlook in life, and I'm sure it does for everybody, but I just want to emulate who he was and the things that he did, and I want my kids to look at me like I looked at him growing up. But just the emotions, there were years to where there was like no emotions because I didn't have kids. I was young and living in a ski resort, and so it was there, but it wasn't as prevalent. When kids came along, it got really prevalent. And I feel like in the last probably 5 years since I moved back to Oklahoma, being close to family, being more grounded, and I feel like I've grown a lot and been a better person that I wanted to be, that my kids need me to be, and that just following in his footsteps and talking to his old partners and agents and my family. And I feel that and I hear that from them and from my friends from years back. So
is there something to make people understand this emotional journey that you went through in the last 25 years? Is there anything you'd like to tell them?
Just never forget. Never forget. And this is always about awareness. I will always, 25 more years down the road, I want people to still be talking about it. I want them to talk about the victims, but I also want them to talk about being kind to one another and talk about that it wasn't just the act. We lost lives. There were lives lost. There were children lost. And that 25 years down the road, 25 more years down the road, I want people to remember. Google it, look it up, come to Oklahoma City, go to the museum, take a tour. But also just don't ever forget. And from a personal experience, it does change you. And if you've gone through anything of just losing somebody, choose joy. Choose joy.
I believe I said it at the 20 year and in an interview, and what I would tell to somebody, whether it be if somebody has something catastrophic or they lose just a mother or father from old age or something, it never goes away. And I don't feel like it ever will for her and I. And I can't say that it gets easier because, like I said, it's a roller coaster, and one day may be fantastic. The next day or the next hour, maybe something triggers you. But for me, it just gets doable. You can carry on, and you will have great times and great remembrances, and you'll have those sad days and bad days, but it does get doable, but it never goes away. So appreciate what you had, appreciate what you have now, and know that it could be gone in an instant.
Sir, do you mind introducing yourself?
I'm Glenn Sahl. I was married to Kathy Glenn Sahl. She was a investigative assistant for the Secret Service.
At the beginning here, if you don't mind, we kind of want to just touch on the morning of and just kind of what happened that day, kind of establish your morning and what happened with the incident.
I work out of town quite a bit, and I'd left Monday morning, and I'd been working in Cleveland, Oklahoma, and actually, we heard the explosion, but we didn't know what it was. We were 2.5 hours, 3 hours away, and a sheriff showed up and said I needed to call a gentleman that I was doing these houses for, and I called him, and he wouldn't tell me nothing. He said, you need to load up and get back to Shawnee. And I'd always see highway patrol, usually on the way up there, on the way back, and there wasn't nobody on the highways. The truck I was driving had no radio. I got to the gentleman I was working on these houses for, and he said, we got to go pick Clint up at school. And when we got to school, that's really kind of when I knew something was bad.
And who's Clint?
My youngest son.
And how were you, was that how you were notified?
When I got to school, his teacher come up and hugged me, and she said, I am so sorry, you know. And I said, about what? And she said, someone has bombed the Murrah building, and floored me. I mean, I had no idea.
And how would you describe your late wife?
She was she enjoyed life. I worked out of town a lot, and on the weekends we'd load up and go fishing. She loved to fish. She would take Clint fishing when I was out of town. We lived on a lake for years, and it was really the ideal place to raise a child. I mean, and she'd dig worms. She'd do it all, you know. And she put up with me for 10 years, so she's a good person.
You feel there's a little bit of part of her with you?
Oh, yeah, yeah. She enjoyed life. I mean, she loved the outdoors. She loved camping. And I still go. I mean, we go fishing, me and them boys, grandkids. I mean, we load up and we go. And we all used to go to a lake in southeastern Oklahoma, her mom and dad and everybody. And we hadn't gone down there for years. And then this last summer, we started going back, you know. And it brought back good memories. I mean, we had a lot of good memories down there.
So this might be a tough one. Your most favorite memory?
Of my wife,
yes,
I guess. Sir. I would take Clint with me when he was little bitty, and every time I'd bring him home, you know, he'd have a bump or a bruise or something, and she tapped on the window one day, and she said the phone, and me and Clint was on a riding lawnmower, so I stopped the lawnmower, and I said, don't take off or nothing. I'll be right back. So I go in the house, and I hear Kathy screaming. And she said, I'm going to, you know, beat you to death. And so 2 days later, I brought him home a go-kart, and she said, what the hell's wrong with you? You know, and I said, you didn't say anything about a go-kart. You said the lawnmower. And she said, if that kid gets hurt, she said, I will literally kill you. And he's riding this go-kart, and like I said, we lived on the lake, and the throttle stuck, and the kid goes right out. Her sitting there, you know, I thought, oh, I'm in trouble, you know, but just stuff like that, you know. But, yeah, and I have a lot of good memories of Kathy. I don't know what you call them, they're those open reels. I mean, they're,
reel
I can't
reel.
Use them. You know, I use the old Zebcos, but, hey, she's you know, tried to show me how to use them, but okay. I jackknife them. I call it jackknife, but bird's nest, she could use them, you know. I mean, I couldn't. I mean, I still can't. I've got three of them out there, and they're just, I use them for trolling, you know.
Okay.
I can't use them, but she was a fisherman. I mean, she loved to fish. I mean.
What type of, forgive my ignorance, but what type of fishing?
We had bass fish, crappie, catfish, but we lived on a lake right down the road, actually, here. And when I was gone, she would go dig, like I said, dig worms for Clint. And they would go out there and fish. And she would let me take him deer hunting, you know. But I would get the, you know, I would get the business before we went. But her sister called one day and she said, "Hey, is Kathy all right?" And I said, "I don't know. What do you mean?" You know, like I thought something was going on. And I said, "What's going on?" And she said, "Well, she must be crazy to let you take that baby deer home." I said, "Oh, he'll be all right." You know, but we had good times. I mean, he got one time, first time I never got chewed out for him getting hurt. I mean, you know, she didn't chew too bad, but I took him to work with him and a dog got him in the face. Scared the daylights out of me. I took him to the emergency room in Edmond, actually. And I was sitting there and I thought, "Oh God, I got to call Kathy," you know? So I called her and she showed up. And I think she seen kind of the fear and she never, you know, never said nothing, you know? But I mean, it was all good, you know? I mean, it was all good.
A project that your son did, when we heard it, I believe, from Marianne from the museum. I was wondering if you wouldn't mind sharing a story about the pennies.
I think it was that lady that runs the museum had called and said, "Glenn, they're trying to raise money for chairs." And she said, and a lot of people have suggested Clint, you know, that because Clint is always 70, had a deep voice, you know, said, "I think he would probably fit in this scenario to help raise money." And so I went down and I met Chantel Smith, was I think Miss America at the time, and so they had a penny, I think it was called either a penny for my mom or a penny for my chair or something campaign. And I got to go to one, was in Tulsa, and I was really moved about how they presented this, you know, speech and everything. Clint got up there and he talked about, you know, that, "Hey, look, you know, we're needing help, but we need money to raise, you know, money for these chairs." And he said, "If y'all come up there and you get tired, you find my mom's chair and you sit down and rest," you know? And it went on for probably a good hour. And then when it was over, this lady comes up to me and she goes, "You know what school this is, don't you?" And I said, "No, ma'am." She said, "Well, this is these kids' last chance." She said, "Most of them, if they don't make it here, they're either in jail or juvie or something." And she said, and I looked out there and she said, "I seen more these tough boys with tears in their eyes." And they were even coming up to Clint and hugging him. This one kid, tough guy, had the tear in his eye, you know, the tattoo and everything. And he was talking to Clint, and Clint said, "What are you going to do?" And he said, "I'm going to go home and tell my mom I love her," you know? And I mean, it was pretty touching. I mean, it was, you know, and they raised, I think, almost $500,000 in pennies, you know. So pretty good little program.
We're reaching the 25th anniversary coming up here in April. What is life like for you now, so many years later?
Life has been good. I find out the older you get, a gentleman told me, I was in the hospital, and he said, he's about 90 years old, and he said, "What are you doing in here, Sonny?" And I said, "Well, thanks a lot for that." And I told him, I said, "Well, I've got pneumonia." And he said, "Well, he looked around, he goes, let me tell you something, you can't be a sissy and get old." You know, and he was right. I mean, it gets tougher. I've had a stent put in, I've had all kinds of health problems, but I overcome it and I just keep going. You know, a man that raised me one time, he was 80 years old, and he said, "You know, I wished I had another 20 years. And I said, "What would you do?" And he said, "Nothing. I just keep doing what I'm doing." And that's the way I look at it. I mean, he went and bought a motorcycle when he was 81 years old. And I asked him one day, and he said, "I'm not going to let age interfere with what I want to do." He said, "I know I'm too old to ride that motorcycle." He said, "By God, I'm going to go buy it." And he said, "Oh, if I ride it one time, I've done it, you know." But he didn't let age deter him. And that's the way I look at it. I'm just going to keep on going.
To this day, is there anything that you still remember her with or by, or is it something that you just keep in memory?
There's not a day goes by that I don't think about Kathy. And there's always those ifs, you know, like she was getting ready to go out of town to Arizona. And when I found out what that happened, I kept thinking, well, maybe she's not there. Maybe she's out buying tickets or, you know, doing what, but she was, you know. But no, I have pictures and, you know, There's not, you know, like I said, there's not a day goes by you don't think about them. Actually, Diane Leonard told me one time that it's like a hole in your heart and there's nothing there that can fill it. And it's true, there's not. I mean, it's there and it'll always be there. It don't seem like 25 years.
There's a whole other generation coming in. And so of new people that weren't even born when this happened, and is there any words you might have to be able to like kind of talk to them or at least tell them, you know, the grief that you've gone through and any advice you may give?
Well, I think we're going to be thrown, I don't know if you'd call it conflict, or we're going to be thrown, what's the word I'm trying to find? All of our life we're going to have obstacles to deal with. And I think if you set your mind that you can deal with anything. I mean, you can just, you know, I think I tell people, just appreciate what you've got and just keep on going forward. Don't dwell in the past. Just go forward. Make the best out of your life, because we're only here for a short while.
So I was going to ask you if there was anything specifically you'd want to mention or anything that you would want to talk about in any of the conversation today. Anything I might have missed or something that you feel would be special to at least tell the camera? Or, sorry, to tell me. I apologize.
Well, I am thankful for my son, his wife, my grandkids. They keep you going. I have some good-looking grandkids. I mean, I'm really proud. And I'm real proud of Clint that he turned out to be a good young man. I mean, he works two jobs. He's a plumber and he's a fireman, and he's a good kid. And I'm blessed, you know.
And do you tell her story? Do the grandchildren know? Is it important to?
Yeah, Clint's taken them to the memorial, and they've gone through the museum down there, and they know when April 19th's coming around. You know, what's sad, you know, I mean, Clint, you know, 7 years old and lost his mom, and I've always felt really bad about that, you know, I mean, almost guilt about it, and but he's overcome, you know, all that, and lost his grandma and grandpa, and if Kathy's mom, if anybody ever deserved to go to heaven, that woman did. She took care of grandpa. Grandpa had dementia, and I think she knew it, but she didn't do anything about it. She was dying with cancer and didn't even, she just was so focused on taking care of him. He passed away, and she didn't live much longer after that. But I think she was just too worried about him to worry about herself, you know. Good woman, though. I think, you know, that's where Kathy and her, there's one sister left, Wanda, and she's doing okay. You know, they live just straight east of here. They go camping quite a bit, but yeah, just keep on going.
Diane Leonard. I was the wife of Don Leonard, who was one of the Secret Service agents that we lost that day.
And how old were you at the time, and how old was he at the time?
He was 50, and I was 48.
What did your husband do for the Secret Service?
Well, he was actually, someone had asked him to go across the street. One of the other agents had to be in court, but Don said, no, I've got to stay back in the office because we have a visit tomorrow in Tulsa, which is 100 miles away. I think it was Mrs. Bush that was coming in. Don't remember for sure, but I think that's who it was. So he stayed in the office, had that last opportunity to go, but he needed to get his work done. So.
And can you kind of walk us through that morning about how that morning played out?
I was a sales rep at that time, and I worked out of town, and of course Don was in and out of town also. I had left the day before to go to Tulsa, to work in Tulsa. So the morning of the bombing, I was in Tulsa working, and I actually didn't have my car radio on. I was
going in to see my customers, and the one customer that morning, I just went in the back room and I took care of ordering what he needed, and no one really saw me come and go. But that I went into the next appointment, and she looked at me and said, "What are you doing here?" And I said, "Well, we had an appointment." And she said, "Do you know what's happened in Oklahoma City?" And I said, "No." So she told me, and I thought, oh, it was just a gas explosion. But she insisted that I call someone. So I thought, how strange. Why is she so insistent? I didn't know the magnitude of it at the time. So I called the local Secret Service office in Tulsa and said, "Can you explain to me what's going on?" And they said, "Oh, we're not sure. We have some people missing. We're not sure who." I know they did know. They just couldn't tell me. And so then I called home and talked to the boys. They're Don's sons from a previous marriage, so my stepsons. And they told me he was one of the missing. So I then, my customer wanted to come with me, and I said, "How would you get home?" So I said, I can get home. And so I drove from Tulsa about 100 miles an hour, and I was praying and trying to find information on the radio. And I kept hearing about Waco. They were talking about the Waco connection that day. And then I finally heard they were bringing in 200 body bags. So I said, "Oh, dear Lord, not another body bag." My mother had committed suicide a few years earlier and was in a body bag. So anyway, I just kept praying and trying to find information on the radio. I finally got home. The boys were there. And I told them to stay there, answer the phone. And I was going to go down. Don's sister was there also. And she and I went down to a family center that had been set up. It was at a church north of downtown. And we went in there. There was a table inside. And you had to describe what your loved one had on that day. Well, I had no idea because I was out of town that morning. So I said, "Sometimes it's a suit. Sometimes it's casual clothes. It depends on what he's working that day." So they said, "Wait over here for someone to talk to you." Well, I went. There were a lot of people in that church, and I went up to one of the people that was speaking to a young couple, and I just said, "Can you tell me who you are?" And he said he was so-and-so from so-and-so funeral home. And that's all I needed to hear. I was out of there. I left immediately. Didn't need a funeral director. Didn't want to talk to one. So then I went down to St. Anthony's downtown, where the survivors were taken, most of them, I think. And they had an area there where we, again, walked in, left our name at a table, and told who we were there for. I remember they had pieces of paper all along one long, long wall and around both ends on the adjacent walls. And the paper was about 3 feet by 3 feet, and each piece had two columns of names on them. And so I told Don's sister, "You start at that end, I'll start at this end, and we'll see if we see his name." And we met in the middle, and we didn't find his name, either of us. So I said, "Let me double check you, you double check me." So we did that, and then didn't find him, of course. But there were several John Does and Jane Does on those lists. So I went to the table and asked if they would, could they give me descriptions of the John Does so I could maybe identify one for them. they didn't have descriptions, which I found amazing. I said, you need to get descriptions so people can help you find these folks. So anyway, I remember seeing an ATF jacket in that room, a guy with an ATF jacket. So I went to him then and identified myself, and I said, can you tell me where the Secret Service CP would be? And he said, if your husband was in that building, I've seen things like this before, he's gone. And I did not need to hear that at that moment. I was not ready to give up hope. So I left again, and I went home. And I was home. We waited 3 days. We were lucky. Many had to wait longer. During that waiting, I finally thought one day, okay, I asked one of the agents that was there to take me to my church to speak to the pastor and take me to a funeral home. And when I went to the funeral home, I said, I don't think I'm going to need you, but just in case. And I told the agent, I don't want Don, if he's gone, I don't want him transported all over town. I want him taken directly to the funeral home from the ME's office. So they worked at doing that. I know they were putting them in temporary morgues and they were moving them about. So I just wanted him to be able to come straight to the funeral home. So I told them that, I guess that they worked that out. They did everything they could. So he, 3 days later, he was, they did come to the house and notify us. And I was able to go to the funeral home the next day.
And what would be the best way to describe Don?
What he was like. He was a man of faith, and he loved this country very much, and he so loved his family. He was a big guy. He was 6'2", and a very happy guy. He smiled most of the time.
And how did you two meet?
We both were working at the Federal Building in Tulsa, Oklahoma. He started his career in Oklahoma City at the Secret Service office here, but then he was transferred to Tulsa, and I was working there for the Postal Inspection Service, and I met him there because they work with the Inspection Service.
And how long did it take for you to get married?
Oh, gosh. Well, that hurried up because he got transferred to Washington. I don't even remember now how long it was, but less than a year. And he got that transfer, so we decided to get married before he was transferred. So we moved to Washington, and then we spent time in St. Louis after his protection duty. I think we were there about 3 years, and then he was transferred to St. Louis. And then he was very excited about getting transferred back to his hometown, Oklahoma City.
And you don't have to share it. I just wanted to ask if anything, like, was there anything special between you, like a special language, or if there was like something that, a small object, something that you knew, how can I say this, a special item between each other or a special way of communicating?
The communication, since both of us traveled, whoever was out of town would call the other one every night. So we always spoke every night. And I was the one that called him on April 18th because I was out of town. And we always ended with, I love you. And of course, not knowing on the 18th, that would be the last time I'd get to say that.
We have the 25th anniversary coming up, mm-hmm. On April 19th. Mm-hmm. What are the things that you've done to take care of yourself and to remember him?
Well, gosh, coping mechanism was stay very, very busy. And actually, the day of his funeral, I was on the way to another funeral, Kathy Seidel's funeral, that morning. Don's funeral was in the afternoon. And on the way to that, it came to me, I needed to speak at the funeral, at Don's funeral. And didn't think twice about it, just started writing things down. And Don's brother was with me, and I said, does this make any sense? Because I didn't trust my brain. Your brains don't work normally at a time like that. So he said it did, and asked what I was going to do with it, and I told him, and he said, oh, I don't think you better do that. But I just felt driven, and I didn't think about it until later. I was a sales rep. I would go to sales meetings and not even raise my hand to ask a question because I was so shy. But for some strange reason, I was driven to speak at the funeral. Wondered about it later, and I thought, that was not me. That had to be the Lord. And I thought, no, I had an argument with myself. I'm not close enough to God. I don't do everything I should do, you know. But then I thought, yeah, but you would never have done that. So I finally gave up that battle and decided it was him. And I said, okay, if you have plans, I'll do whatever it is you want me to do. So I ended up shortly thereafter working with our state attorney general's office on death penalty reform. And we worked for a year on it, was back and forth to Washington, lobbying Congress and senators. And a year after, I was in Washington, invited to be on the stage with Clinton when he signed the anti-terrorism bill into law. And our legislation was part of that bill, the death penalty reform. So that was what I spent the first year doing. I'd work during the day and spend evenings on fax machines and writing letters and writing speeches and doing interviews and promoting our cause. But it did finally happen. I remember Orrin Hatch told me, we've tried to do this for years. It took a handful of people from Oklahoma to get it done. After that, I testified in both the federal trials, and I ended up becoming the first victim witness coordinator at our state attorney general's office. As part of that, I was at a conference, and Office for Victims of Crime was there. And I was in a session that they were doing, and it was between the McVeigh and the Nichols trials. And the person conducting the class, we had to each say who we were, and she asked me to stay after class. So I did, and she wanted to know what was done well during the McVeigh trial for all the victims and what wasn't working, because the Nichols trial was coming up. So I told her, you've done incredible things for the family, but it's our rescue community that needs help. I'd been checking on them, and I knew they were having big time problems. So my assignment when I left that conference was to get the police chief, the fire chief, everybody else on board to allow their people to get help. Office for Victims of Crime, the chaplain of the PD, and I wrote a grant request, and it was granted, and we did critical incident workshops for, oh my goodness, I don't even remember now, maybe a couple years. We got funding for those workshops, and it helped a lot of people. We even did one on the East Coast and one on the West to help the teams that responded from those areas.
Do you have anything that you want to speak on your husband, the victims, or the service as far as, or Oklahoma in general? Is there any words you'd like to share or impart or things that you've learned over the years?
There are a couple of things. I think, as I mentioned, I have a passion about people being able to view their loved one if they have that desire. If any law enforcement or any funeral directors, they need to understand. I know they're trying to help these people, by telling them not to view. But in a traumatic event, people don't know to stand up for themselves if they need that. They just do what they're told. And then later, they suffer the consequences. We had, during the trials, I met several people who did not view and were still having nightmares. And I said, there are pictures at the medical examiner's office. I will take you there. And we did go, and it helped many. So my experience served me well in trying to help. I wanted to utilize those two experiences of my mother's suicide and my husband's, and the different way I was able, you know, what I was able to see and what I was not able to see, and the benefits of being able to see if that's what you need. The people will know if they're given the chance to make that decision. They will know what they need to do. Control has totally been taken away from them when an event like that occurs. And it continues by people telling them not to do what they need to do. So they need to make that decision themselves. They'll know what they need. And one other thing that I want to share is about going through difficult events. And with the Lord, you can get through anything. There's nothing too hard. There's no bad event that I've seen, and I've seen a few, that good can't come from. It doesn't minimize the pain or the hurt or the value of the person you lost, but it helps you hang on. And you can just look at the good that comes from. And I saw many good things day one after the bombing. It was amazing the way people reached out and came together, our country united. Those help you hang on.